When words fail, it doesn't mean you can't still win later on. The next presenter needs no introduction. You've seen him on TV in his various documentary series, including John Safran versus God and John Safran's race relations. Doing things like subjecting himself to devotional crucifixion in the Philippines, auditioning for the Harlem Gospel Choir, disguising himself as Prince, and, not in any disguise, trying to join a branch of the Ku Klux Klan. You hear him weekly on Triple J with Father Bob, and more recently, he's turned his pen to true crime with his book Murder in Mississippi, the story of how he met a white supremacist in the Deep South and became entwined in the lives of those connected to the murder. The book was named iBooks 2013 Best Nonfiction. He might have spent a good part of his career as a kind of irreverent anti-hero, but now, writer, broadcaster, and documentarian John Safran might just be in with a fighting chance. Warning, this piece contains strong language. Please ring your bells for the last round tonight. John Safran.
Now, I'm a writer, and us writers like to bang on about the power of words. Words are the mysterious visitors of the soul. I saw that plastered on the wall of a library recently. Now, the literary industrial complex, you know, the people who organise things like the Melbourne Writers' Festival or tell stories on This American Life, will try to sell you on this idea. But screw words. Words are bullshit. Let me tell you, in my true crime writing career, when the chips have been down, I haven't been looking for words. I've been looking for a weapon. And no, Ira Glass, I wasn't looking for words as a weapon. I was looking for an actual weapon. I'll read from a 2005 newspaper article. Talkback caller fined for harassing John Safran. A talkback caller today pleaded guilty to recklessly threatening serious injury and using a telephone to menace after calling into Safran's radio show in December last year. The court heard that the man had been drinking when he rang Safran to tell him he was unoriginal, untalented, and stole jokes from other comedians. During their conversation, Safran challenged the man to meet him in the early hours of the morning near a Melbourne freeway for a fight. The court was told Safran, who was being sarcastic when he made the threat, subsequently told the man he wanted to back out. The man, however, told him it was too late. Oh yes, I've written a lot. I've won an AFI award for writing. But none of these supposed skill sets I'd developed helped me calm down this guy. I had to go to a burly security guard at the ABC and then a policeman, neither who had won any AFI awards, to protect me from the lunatic. Years later, I'm in Mississippi. And once again, I've wound up another angry young man. I'm in a little motel room, and I'm on the phone, and on the other end of the line is a killer, a young black man called Vincent McGee. He's in lockdown in a prison cell. He's not allowed to communicate with anyone outside, but he keeps a contraband cell phone hidden under his mattress. He's serving 65 years for killing a white supremacist back in 2010. He stabbed him so many times around the neck, his head nearly fell off. And as has happened so many times over the months I've been here in Mississippi, I'm trying to get the story out of him for my true crime book. And as has happened so many times over the months, he's trying to squeeze money out of me. "Hey, listen," Vincent McGee says from his prison cell. "Talk down low, because there's a lot of police around here. You hear?" "Yeah, sure. But I'm going to need you to do something for me. You hear? I've got some big business coming through. You hear? Going to need 2,500 and get it in single 100s. You hear?" "I can't give you $2,500. I don't have that much money left. You're going to have to figure out another plan." "No," he says, "you the plan." I laugh. "You're going to need another plan." "Uh-uh," he says. "No, uh-uh. No, uh-uh," I mimic back. "Say, John Safran." "Yes?" "I can get you killed from right behind this door, man. Real talk." "You can get me killed from behind your door?" "Real talk. I can get your motherfucking ass kicked from behind this door if you're playing. I've got niggas right now, on my honour, that can come up to your motherfucking house and put your brains outside the curb." "Pardon?" "I said by a motherfucking player, I can get you killed in your motherfucking house tonight. I got the address on the letter. 5201 Lakeland Boulevard, Flowood, apartment F58. Motherfuckers' brains be in the street." "That's rather scary, you know. It's pretty scary to hear that. I don't understand when you say things like that, whether you're being serious or you're being funny." "No, I ain't laughing. I'm serious. Serious as a motherfucking heart attack or a stroke." I remember then thinking, if Vincent got out, I'd leave town. As a writer, you may have the gift of the gab, but in this scissors, rock, paper game of life, Vincent's knife beats the gift of the gab.
Kick shooting. Kick.
Kick. Cut to last Christmas. I'm in country New South Wales, in a small town called Tarmor. And somehow, I've annoyed an other dangerous man. I'm investigating a murder for Good Weekend magazine. "You don't have any good weekends out here, mate, I can tell ya." One local informs me when I say who I'm writing for. This guy called Scotty has been found bludgeoned to death in his home. The bizarre soundbite on the news was that everyone in town was a suspect. That's how hated Scotty was. My initial conversations at the pub bear this out. "Scotty used to stick his dogs on people," a red-haired woman tells me. "So, you know, like, he was just a scumbag." Nobody's speaking. It's just that no one cares enough to say, "Well, who killed that fella?" Because everyone's going, "Thank God somebody did." "Sure," I say, "but, you know, when a person dies..." "It's not a person," she interrupts. "It's an it. He was an it." Outside the pub, another local tells me he also didn't like Scotty. Scotty once fired an arrow at him. Christ, who was this guy? Anyway, I end up talking to Scotty's niece. She tells me she has a strong idea who the killer is. She says it was a friend of Scotty's who was the last man seen leaving the house. In fact, for legal reasons, that's all I can call him. The last man to leave the house. There were witnesses to the murder, but they're of limited help because they're cockatoos. The niece leads me to them in her garage. "They're in the house with him all the time," she says. "It's full sentences because Scotty was diagnosed with schizophrenia. So he'd sit there by himself and rant and rave. Sometimes it's real creepy." "Shut the fucking door, you cunt!" one of the cockatoos squawks. After I speak to the niece and the cockatoos, I head back to my motel room, attached to the local pub. I track down the last man to leave the house on Facebook. His profile picture shows him huddled up with blokes wearing motorcycle patches from an outlaw motorcycle club. The next morning, I find a woman purporting to be the girlfriend of the last man to leave the house. "Definitely was not him," she says, defending her man. "He loves Scotty too much." She tells me her boyfriend met Scotty in jail long ago. I ask her why her boyfriend was in jail. "He cut someone's ear off," she says. "He's not going to cut off my ear for writing a story," I ask. "Nah, he's calmed down in his old age." I drive my blue rental car back to the pub and park just outside my motel door. Just before 11 p.m, my mobile phone buzzes. The man at the other end of the line tells me someone has passed on my business card. He wants to know who I've been talking to in town. I ask him who he is. He tells me his name. It's the last man to leave the house. "You sound a bit hesitant after hearing my name," he snarls. "Sorry, what was that?" I reply, even though I heard him perfectly well. "You sound a bit hesitant after hearing my name. We should meet up, mate. But where are you staying?" I chuckle back. "Cat got your tongue, Johnny. Where are you staying?" Just with friends. "Oh, you just happen to have friends in this little town." "You're not talking very much, mate." "No." "Hey, John, is that your little blue car parked out front of your room?" "Walk out the front." "No, please don't." "Come on, walk out the front." "Please don't." "Walk out the front." "Are you going to hurt me?" "Fucking walk out the front, cunt." The phone cuts out. I scan the room for a weapon. I grab the fork next to the kettle, squat down by the bed and ring the police. It's getting close to midnight. An hour later, a policeman and policewoman knock on my door. "Mate, it's best just stay away from these people," the policeman says. He says the last man to leave the house has connections to an outlaw motorcycle club with members all over Australia. It's not good, because once they get an eye on where you're staying, shit's going to start. And it's obviously started. I would get out of town if I were you. I speed back to Sydney, sleep by the side of the road, and take the first flight back to Melbourne the next morning. And when I get back to my flat, you know the first thing I do? Me, John Safran, storyteller? Do I think, wow, what a story, and begin typing? No. Do I plot out the story arc of the last few days on my yellow notepad? No. I phone the Krav Maga Centre I've driven past so many times, just up the road from my flat. Krav Maga is a martial art developed by a Jew in Slovakia in the 1930s to fight off anti-Semitic street gangs. This wasn't like the situation with Vincent McGee in Mississippi, where I could catch a plane out of danger. I'd poked the bear in Australia. I walk up stairs to the Krav Maga Centre. Wooden replica guns hang from hooks on the wall. Punching bags shaped like human bodies dangle from the ceiling. A photo of Imi Lichtenfeld, the Jew in Slovakia who started Krav Maga, is screwed to the wall. Only after I've booked my 10 lessons and trained through 3 of them did I then sit down at my desk and begin to plot out my true crime story for the weekend magazine. My point being, words may be the mysterious visitors of the soul, but when the murderer in country New South Wales and the motorcycle gang had my name, I didn't make out like that Nebuchadnezzar Jew Ira Glass from This American Life and write a story. I made out like that street-fighting Jew Imi Lichtenfeld and took up Krav Maga. Words are bullshit. Screw words.
Yeah.
For the benefit of radio listeners, so you know what was happening under that closing music, John Safran just demonstrated what I would describe as spirited, intermediate-level Krav Maga. Punching and kicking hand shields held by his Krav Maga instructor on stage in sporty shorts and a tracky top. That is all for the Radio Hour. Thank you to the amazing writers and producers who shared their stories with you this evening, to our incredible radio supergroup who played all the scoring live and worked tirelessly and with so much patience to bring these stories to musical life, Biddy Connor, Dan Marsh and Matt Ridgway. To the others who have graced the stage tonight, Virginia Bott, choir director, and the 14-piece splendor that is First Chorus Band of Singers, actor Matt Filani, John's Krav instructor Josh, and behind the scenes, but no less central, a huge thanks to Claudia Taranto for executive production and being on the other end of the line these past months to help in all manner of radio quandaries. Also to Joel Supple for Radio Simpatico Consultant Production. Technical personnel tonight, Mal Holt on sound. Stage management by Annie Reed. Siobhan Guinea on lights. ABC sound engineers Tim Simons, Richard Gervin and Matthew Crawford. A very special thanks to Angelica Andritsopoulos, Emily Richmond, John Chia and Rosanna Scarcella for ineffable, unquantifiable, and couldn't do withoutable help. Enjoy the rest of the festival, and good night.
Was the second and final part of the Radio Hour, recorded live for 360 Documentaries as part of the Melbourne Writers Festival. Our hugest thanks to the creator, producer and visionary behind the Radio Hour, Jay Krantz. Next week, you'll meet Oleg, a young Ukrainian lawyer who's kept an audio diary for us over the past year, while thousands were building barricades, confronting tear gas and dodging police sniper bullets in Kiev, as they bravely stood up to the regime of Viktor Yanukovych. This is Yuri, one of Oleg's friends.
На Майдан я офіційно являюсь членом однієї з партій, вона не парламентська.
Yes, I'm a member of a political party, but that's not why I joined the protest. I joined because I'm a citizen of Kyiv. Everyone on Майдан was the same.
На політичних якихось, але основні події, звичайно,
it was common people who decided to change history, not politicians or political parties.
Що себе переодягтися? У нас тут був недалеко мого товариша офіс, і я мав можливість.
I was lucky enough to have a friend with an office near the Maidan, so I used to go and change my clothes there. Of course, I needed protection on the square, because we'd heard hundreds of stories about people being kidnapped just 20 meters from the square, being put into minibuses and then disappearing.
Була і палка, біта була, в мене був лом, каска в мене була.
So I always carried a metal crowbar, which I also used to build barricades. I had a plastic helmet and I wore homemade armor on my legs. Rubber yoga mat around my waist, gloves and balaclava.
Перчатки проти газу в мене був.
I wasn't breaking the law.
Нічого кримінального.
It's a compelling fly-on-the-wall look at what it took to bring down a government, so don't miss it. I'm Kirsty Melville, and I look forward to seeing you next week for 360 Documentaries here on RN. Bye for now.